From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, 11,000 untested rape kits found in a Detroit police lab. 5 years later, only a couple thousand have been tested.
Each kit is a person. It's a woman, it's a man, it's a child, it's a story, it's a life. It's a life that was hurt, that was shattered, that may or may not ever be the same after that kit was taken.
Plus, the upcoming Grand Prix on Belle Isle, Detroit's bankruptcy, and Roger Penske.
He said, we're going to move through this, and it's going to ultimately be a win. And I think that's not an unfair way to look at things.
And how robots could impact jobs in Michigan.
People are basically understanding that this is the way the economy is going, and they're adapting to it.
Those stories and more today for you on Stateside. ...11,000 rape kits were discovered abandoned in Detroit Police Crime Lab 5 years ago. Since then, only about 2,000 of the kits have undergone DNA testing. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, why have thousands of rape kits still gone untested? And what's the broader message sent to victims of rape? Then later in the hour, a recent Oxford University report warns that robots could replace nearly half of the current U.S. workforce. Or really, could they? Can humans keep ahead of the technology that's changing our workforce? But first, a poll released today by the group Business Leaders for Michigan finds that 66% of Michigan voters support Governor Snyder's pledge to have the state contribute to help settle Detroit's bankruptcy. The survey finds 20% of voters oppose the state contribution and slightly more than 13% don't know if they're for or against. There have been several ideas floated as to how much the state might give to what's known as the grand bargain, whether it would be a lump sum or spread out over a number of years, the installment plan, and from where that money would come. Well, today folks are getting a look at legislation that could spell all of that out. Detroit News reporter Chad Livengood is at the Capitol. Hi, Chad.
Thanks for having me today.
Good to have you with us. So, tobacco settlement money, rainy day fund, lump sum, installment plan. What are you hearing from the House today?
Well, what Representative John Walsh, a Republican from Livonia, he's the Speaker Pro Tem of the House, and he's been tapped to lead this special committee to handle this legislation. He just let the press know just now that the bills are going to include a lump sum payment of $195 million that would come from the rainy day fund of the state. It's about a $580 million fund right now, and it will be repaid. That contribution from the rainy day fund would be repaid by tobacco settlement funds. Every year, the state of Michigan gets about $250 million from the tobacco companies as part of the big mid-1990s multi-state lawsuit settlement over claims. So they're going to replenish the savings account of the state, but the plan would call for dipping into it now to make that payment to put towards the grand bargain and put towards the settlement of the bankruptcy immediately.
So we know this new poll that was on the front page of the news today from the Business Leaders for Michigan, and that's a group of top Michigan CEOs indicating voters' support for helping Detroit, but that's just one poll. What kind of support do you think, Chad, that this proposal has in the House?
Well, it's kind of how, it depends on how you term it. When you term it aid for pensioners in exchange for protecting the art, it polls well. It polls from the mid-50s up into the mid-60s. When you use the word Detroit bailout, as the Mackinac Center did in its own poll, then it doesn't break 50%, and it becomes a different proposition there. So some of it depends on sort of your perspective of what's going on here, and if you view this as a bailout, any term you can use pretty much applies to this thing, rescue. So it's still not clear, you know, whether this thing is going to get passed. I mean, there's a lot of variables, like any other legislation. Democrats seemingly are on board with it, but they got concerns about the oversight issues. That's one thing that came out today, that there's going to be a seven-member control board, essentially, that will have oversight over Detroit's finances for the next up to 20 years, which is the duration of the bankruptcy court's ability to essentially retain jurisdiction over the city and supervision of the city's finances. And so that's another aspect, because the proposal calls for just one appointee from the city of Detroit by the mayor of Detroit, and the other six appointees will be appointed by legislative leaders, the state treasurer, and the governor. That's going to probably be an issue that, that Democrats are going to try to fight to get at least our city council representative on that control board.
I could see that being perhaps a tough sell in Detroit.
Yeah, because all it does is perpetuates that the state of Michigan is going to continue to essentially have a permanent occupation at City Hall in Detroit. And at the same time, the leadership is trying to stress, you know, look, there's provisions in this thing that during the 20 years, if they're doing well, budgets, the board can go dormant. That's what happened in the state of New York when the state of New York implemented tough controls on New York City in 1975. The New York State Control Board was in pretty much tight control of the finances for 10 years following, and to this day is still in existence, but in a dormant state where they essentially issue reports every couple of years, but don't really do anything unless we had another financial emergency in the Big Apple.
Chad, what if Speaker Jace Bolger's demand that came out a few weeks ago that he wants Detroit unions to pony up some cash to this grand bargain, where does that stand and could it be a deal breaker?
It could still be a deal breaker, especially for the Democrats. I talked to an AFSCME lobbyist in the hallway just briefly today, and I said, are you guys going to cave to Bolger's demand? And his reply was, no. And I think that's being negotiated right now in leadership as we speak. So something tells me that, you know, there's going to be a grander bargain up here, okay?
Yeah.
And some people are going to have to give and take. Just yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Randy Richterville said he's not really in favor of using the rainy day fund to make a lump sum payment. He'd rather make $17.5 million payments every year for the next 20 years.
Hmm.
So there's already clear differences, even between the two chambers and the two Republican leaders, because Jace Bolger and a lot of the Republican House members, they're in favor of write a check, settling now, one time, this is it.
Which I get the feeling from things we've seen Kevin Orr say, he'd be all for that, too. Let's get that money and be able to work with it.
Well, he understands that if you put the money now into the fund, it will help the pension fund immediately.
Mm-hmm.
There's another component to this. This is where it gets into bailout talk. The city of Detroit has not made a single payment towards its two pension funds since November of 2012. It has been skipping payments quarter and month after month since then, and that roughly they are $250 million behind in payments. So if you fork up $195 million in state money, it'll look like essentially the taxpayers are paying the bill that the city has been unable to do for the last 2 years.
Then that could easily fill in the term bailout to address that.
Yes. So I mean, this is also going to tie into other subjects that are going on up here. It's budget season in Lansing. Next week is a revenue estimating conference on Thursday, and there are some legislators who are looking for more money for roads, for projects in their districts, for certain departments, for education, and even for tax cuts. So there is no shortage of wants and demands. That's why the House leadership is you know, and the governor is eyeing the rainy day fund, because it's a money that's available right now and wouldn't have to disrupt the pork barrel apple cart, I guess.
Chad, what's the process now? So the House puts its version down. Does the Senate do their version and then let's hammer out differences?
The Senate is not doing anything. That's not unusual. Sometimes they will try to pass competing bills, but the Senate is seemingly letting the House take the lead here. The House, there's a special committee that's been formed to handle this bill, and they're going to begin hearings next Tuesday at the earliest. And they will work on it, and then they will get this package out. I mean, and then the other thing you got to consider is that the clock is kind of winding down in the legislature. These guys, especially the ones who have primaries, they want to get out of town as early as possible in June. They don't want to go all the way to the end of June. They want to get out as soon as possible. So they may be motivated to make deals and get this over with, or it could turn into Medicaid like last summer.
Oh boy.
Where the Senate at the end of June was not going to be pressured by the governor, who was in Israel on a trade mission and flew back all the way across the globe to
scolded
try to lobby them.
Yeah, that's right.
And then when they decide not to hold a vote, he famously said, take a vote, not a vacation. I don't think the governor is going to be doing that again this year, but it could turn into a situation like that. Now, there's a caveat to that. If that happens, it's where the grand bargain essentially dissolves. And because the Judge Rhodes in the bankruptcy case has stipulated, and they put it in the language of the plan, if the legislature does not pass this bill by the start of the confirmation trial,
right,
which is scheduled for July 24th, any retiree who votes yes, as in voting starts next Monday when these packets start to go out in the mail, these ballots,
right,
anybody who votes yes, their vote will be turned into a no vote if the legislature fails to come through with its end of the deal.
Wow.
So that's where this thing could go off the rails, and then we would have essentially either had to start over on a new plan, or there would be a cram down in bankruptcy court of huge and unprecedented proportions.
Detroit News Capitol reporter Chad Livengood bringing us the latest on the House proposal toward the Detroit bankruptcy grand bargain. Chad, thank you so much.
Chad, thanks for having me.
State Representative Dan Lowers was on the program yesterday. We talked about his bill that would let police do roadside saliva tests on drivers suspected of being under the influence of drugs. Well, today came word that the saliva test provision will be removed from the drugged driving bill package. Representative Lauer said he decided to remove the saliva testing provision until the science and technology is perfected, which at this point, it's not. Now that the saliva test is out of the picture, police would have to rely on field sobriety tests to tell whether a driver is indeed under the influence of drugs. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 11,000 rape kits discovered abandoned in a Detroit police warehouse. That was 5 years ago. The discovery sparked outrage. But since that time, only about 2,000 of these kits have undergone DNA testing. Rebecca Campbell is a professor of community psychology and program evaluation at Michigan State University. She was brought on board by the National Institute of Justice to evaluate how those Detroit rape kits were handled. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you very much.
Can you give us a refresher? Take us back to what it was that caused those rape kits to wind up abandoned in a Detroit police warehouse.
This is a problem 30 years in the making. These kits go way back, 10 years ago. 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So we really have to take a long-term perspective to understand how and why Detroit has so many untested sexual assault kits.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly part of the problem had to do with the resources available in the Detroit Police Department, Detroit Crime Lab, lots of other organizations in the Detroit community over time. As we all know, Detroit is a community that has been struggling financially for so many years to be able to serve its population, to serve the people of this city. And for a long period of time, the agencies that were tasked with helping rape victims really were under-resourced in being able to do this. So, for example, the Detroit Crime Lab had two DNA scientists, two. Now, if that sounds like not very much, you're right. It's not very much.
Right.
When we look comparatively at other cities that have had similar crime rates, similar populations over a similar period of time, it wouldn't be atypical that they had 6, 8, 14 DNA scientists. Detroit had two.
Mm.
Another way to put it in perspective is the city of Dallas, for example. Very similar in crime rate, population at the time was very similar. They had two laboratories. Detroit had two people.
And one overworked laboratory.
Exactly. So from just a capacity perspective, it would have been extremely difficult for the Detroit laboratory to keep up with the supply, to keep up with what the crime rate was in Detroit and to test all of those kits. Similarly, the Detroit Police Department Sex Crimes Unit went through not one, but two major staffing cuts, two 50% cuts in their staffing levels over this period of time. So their capacity to be able to keep up with victims of this crime and pursue these cases was very limited. There were other contextual factors in Detroit. The prosecutor's office has also faced staggering budget cuts over the course of time in being able to work with police to bring these cases forward and to bring them into trial. the community of Detroit did not have a sexual assault nurse examiner program until very recently, about 2006. And that's important because SANE programs, or SAFE programs as they're often called, are considered national best practice. And they've been around since the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. Detroit didn't get one until 2006. So having good quality rape exams and good quality evidence collection didn't even happen until very, very recently. So the idea that these kits might have contained useful information, nobody really knew because they weren't being collected with the best state-of-the-art practitioners and equipment.
So they get collected and just kind of put on a shelf.
Correct.
And when I hear you spell out how undercut the sex crimes unit was and that there were only two DNA scientists realizing the sheer amount of sex crimes that you know were happening, what does that say to us about the way that these victims have been viewed?
As not a priority, and that's the key part of this, too. It's not just that the crime lab and the police department didn't have enough resources. What resources they had, they chose not to put into this issue, not to put into this crime. So it's both. It's not just that they were under-resourced, but also that institutionally, this has not been a priority crime historically for the Detroit Police Department. They did not put adequate resources to this, and it does not appear that they really invested substantial effort in trying to address the resource problems that they were having to address victims of this very, very heinous crime.
So there we have kits going back 30 years. So that means we have rapists strolling around free as birds, and we have victims who may never see justice.
Unfortunately, that is the situation. That is the situation that we know from other social science research that most rapists are serial rapists, particularly if they're not caught, if not apprehended, because what they learn then is, oh, I can keep doing this, and I will keep doing this without consequence. So it becomes a major public safety issue. And for victims, it sends a very, very terrifying message of what happened to them doesn't matter, that they don't matter, that their health and well-being doesn't matter. And so that can be very, very troubling to survivors as they're trying to move forward with their recovery.
And we know some 2,000 of these kits are being tested now, Rebecca, but that's not all it takes to make justice happen. What happens after they get tested? We're looking at first money and time to do the DNA testing, and then what?
Yeah, testing is really the tip of the iceberg. There's been a lot of public attention to testing, which is absolutely critical, but it is just the first step in a very long process. The testing has to be done. That takes time. That takes money. And the time is important there because it needs to be done right. It has to go through scientific review. It has to be accurate. Very, very important. But then, what's next? Okay, so it's been tested. Did you get what's called a hit or a match out of CODIS, which is the federal DNA database? Does that give you information, for example, in a stranger rape, who the possible perpetrator is? Well, then the investigators need to find that person. And because these kits go back 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, this is not an easy task. We're not talking about a fresh crime scene. We're not talking about a fresh case. We're talking about going way back in time, potentially, to try to find the victim, to try to find the perpetrator, to try to find witnesses, to see was there any other crime scene evidence that was collected that's also sitting in property, waiting to be tested, waiting to be evaluated. So it takes quite a bit of time, then, to find all the pieces and parts and build an investigative case. Then it needs to move forward to the prosecutor's office where it needs to be evaluated, whether there'll be a warrant issued, and then it can start moving through the criminal justice system for prosecution, which can take anywhere from 9 months to 2 years, depending upon the complexity of the case at hand.
And meantime, we have heard nothing but problems from the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office in terms of budget and staffing because of the troubles, money troubles. Certainly Detroit police are not up to fighting form, and Michigan State Police, they're working some fierce overtime, aren't they?
They are. This community, all parts of this community, are incredibly overtaxed. The cuts that are happening to the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office, this could not come at a worse time. At a time where the volume of work to be done has skyrocketed through the discovery and testing of these kits, this is the time. This is now when they need the prosecutors because they have the will, they have the skills, they have the expertise. What's unique about the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office relative to other communities throughout the United States that have had problems with large numbers of untested kits is that this is a prosecutor, this is a community of prosecutors who really are invested in taking as many of these cases to trial as absolutely possible. They want to move forward on as many cases as they can as a public safety issue and for justice for victims. That has not been true in all jurisdictions that have had this kind of problem. For example, in Los Angeles, very few cases were ultimately prosecuted, even though they tested a whole bunch of them, because the prosecutors weren't on board. They are on board here in Detroit, and they need the resources to keep moving forward with these prosecutions and convictions.
Rebecca, as you were brought on board by the National Institute of Justice to evaluate just how these Detroit rape kits were handled, I sense a lot of passion in what you're saying. Is it the thought of the fact that each kit represents some woman who has not seen justice?
Each kit is a person. It's a woman, it's a man, it's a child, it's a boy, it's a girl, it's a story, it's a life. It's a life that was hurt, that was shattered, that may or may not ever be the same after that kit was taken. So there's a public safety issue, yes. There's a public justice issue, yes. There's also a human rights issue here of what do we owe these survivors, how do we make them whole, what can we be, as a society be doing to make them whole again.
And we know that the state legislature approved $4 million for helping to test the kits. That, I take it, is a drop in the bucket in terms of what's needed in terms of money and manpower.
That's correct. The money that was afforded by the Attorney General's office and governors will fund the testing. But as we've talked about, mm-hmm. testing is the tip of the iceberg. There's the investigation, the victim notification, the prosecution, and the victim advocacy services. There's a lot more that needs to be done to move these cases forward through the criminal justice system.
Rebecca Campbell, Professor of Community Psychology and Program Evaluation at Michigan State University. It has been great to talk with you, and thank you so much for your insights, Rebecca.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
It's called the EB-5. It's a federal visa program that offers a conditional green card to foreign nationals who invest $1 million in a qualified project in the U.S. or invest $500,000 in depressed urban or rural areas. EB-5 is the cornerstone of Governor Snyder's strategy to attract more immigrants to Michigan. In fact, Michigan will be only the second state in the nation to open a statewide center to attract immigrant investment and offer this possible path to citizenship. The first state to do so was Vermont. Brent Raymond is the director of that state's EB-5 Regional Center. Welcome, Brent.
Thank you, Cindy. Pleasure to be speaking with you.
Brent, give us a sense of the nuts and bolts of how your program works.
Well, the Vermont EB-5 Regional Center was approved back in 1997. We actually didn't move forward with approving a project until 2006. And since then, we have had an excellent track record. The nuts and bolts are that we are a regional center that's owned by the state and administered and managed by the state. And we are an independent arm researching different projects, developers, business people that come to us that are interested in creating an EB-5 project. And we approve less than 5% of those projects that come to us.
Now, we've been told by Governor Snyder that the Center in Michigan will provide visas for people who invest at least $1 million in the state and create at least 10 jobs. And do you have that job creation requirement as well in Vermont?
Yeah, United States Citizens and Immigration Service, under EB-5, that is the requirement,
okay.
is 10 jobs created per investor. And there's two amounts. There's $1 million, and then there's a $500,000 qualifying amount if you're in what's called a targeted employment area. And a targeted employment area essentially means that you are a rural area, or you can be urban with a high unemployment, and that, too, would qualify you as a TEA.
Now, Governor Snyder is saying that he expects Michigan's Immigrant Investment Center to bring in more money, more jobs. He's predicting at least $30 million in creating 600 new jobs each year. How does that square with your experience with what you've been doing in Vermont?
$30 million a year, I think, is attainable. That would square with Vermont and what we've achieved since 2007 when we approved our first project.
And as we talk about projects, Brent, give us an idea of the kinds of projects that have been funded in Vermont.
A majority are ski-related. The first project we approved was JP Resort. They came back after that, and they've actually had several projects. So in Vermont, it's attracted ski resorts, and Vermont is, the ski destination of the East.
Mm-hmm.
But we've also had manufacturing companies, and so it works best as far as marketing purposes to the Chinese, which they're really the 800-pound gorilla, because there's lots of multimillionaire Chinese. They are most attracted to real estate projects, but we have had success with manufacturing projects as well.
Brent, as things came together in Michigan to make Michigan the second state in the country to open a statewide EB-5 center, there were critics who voiced concern that the program sets up two classes of immigrants. You've got the wealthier person who can use EB-5 and, in essence, jump to the head of the queue and get that U.S. visa, and then the less well-off who are waiting and who are not necessarily welcomed with the same open arms. Did you have that conversation in Vermont, and what would you say about those concerns?
There are some people on the left and some people on the right that criticize the program, and they use that term, they're jumping in line.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's many different visas out there that are available to many different countries, to many different people. Vermont has a long history of accepting refugees from around the world, and this is EB-5, so this is an employment-based fifth preference. So just in an employment-based visa category, this is one of five lines. So there's no jumping in front of any one line. There's actually multiple types of visas that can be obtained, and this is just one type with a very small quota. The number is very, very limited.
Can you give us a sense, Brent, as far as what your program has meant to Vermont in terms of money that's come into the state and in terms of jobs?
Yeah, literally thousands of jobs. Now, if you're to look at that, a lot of them would be construction jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at key indicators for the economy, a strong and healthy construction industry is very important to the economy, and it's also permanent jobs. We've had over $300 million injected into our economy through EB-5 in projects that are fully funded and have, their projects are at the final phases. The economic analysis that has been done has shown that in the areas where these projects have occurred, there's definitely an upswing in the economy, that's borne out by independent economic analysis. Also, we've approved a project that's considered at risk. So there was a project that went through a downturn during the global recession. They had a good track record, so we felt that the project would be was going to be affected temporarily by the recession, and they created a good strong business plan. So we approved it, and a couple hundred jobs were saved that otherwise these people would have been laid off during the recession.
Mm.
So it's not only always about job creation, but Vermont has used EB-5 very successfully to prevent hundreds of people being laid off due to global economic situation.
Brent Raymond directs Vermont's EB-5 Regional Center, and that was the first one in the nation to offer a statewide center to attract immigrant investment. And we are going to become, in Michigan, the second state to open the statewide center. In fact, state officials say Michigan's new EB-5 center could close on its first project by the end of this year. Brent, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Belle Isle is getting primped and polished for the upcoming Grand Prix, officially the Chevrolet Detroit Belle Isle Grand Prix. It's happening May 30th through June 1st. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is covering the preparations. And Daniel, it's the first time this race has been held since the state took over managing Belle Isle. So what's been done to prepare for the race and fix up the island?
Well, it's just the beginning, I think. You know, they've taken out about 200 diseased trees. They've removed asbestos from the casino. They've repaired some roofs on some of the pavilions, and that's just the beginning. I think after this race in the pipeline, they're going to be doing some more sewer work, water drainage. They've also repaired a lot of the restrooms there. So you're going to see a lot fewer porta-potties if you go to the race this the end of the month. About 110,000 people they're expecting, give or take. They're a little bit ahead of sales this year. I think there's a little bit more excitement about what's going on in Detroit, and people have got some money to spend.
In fact, so there's money to spend. What does this race mean in the best guess in terms of dollars and cents?
That's really hard. Well, they talk about economic spinoff.
Right.
I think the number they're throwing around is about $45 million to the city of Detroit. There's always a lot of criticism about whether those numbers are real or they're manufactured. There have been academic studies done on the value of having sporting events in your town, and economists have cast doubt on them. But I think the broader significance here is this is happening at a time that the city's in bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of national attention to that that I think is somewhat disjointed and disconnected from what we who live and work here and talk about this stuff on a daily and weekly basis know to be happening in the city in general. To read some of the national coverage, you'd think that the place is totally falling down. But when you get on the ground and you look at what's happening, it's a very different picture.
And someone like Roger Penske, who's, you know, has been such a part of trying to turn around Detroit, including leading the Super Bowl effort a dozen years ago, what did he say to you as far as his awareness of the kind of images this race will send out?
Roger is a very interesting guy. As a lot of your listeners know, he's a very accomplished businessman, very successful. He's the owner of – he's got had more than anybody in history. The guy knows what it means to win. He's very meticulous, but I think he also is very realistic. He is not easily dissuaded by the negative aspects of what he sees in Detroit. He knows they're there. Focuses a lot more on the positive and on the forward motion. I mean, when he talked about bankruptcy yesterday, he said, look, this is something that had to happen. But this is why, when you have so much financial distress for so long, something's got to happen. But this is why we have bankruptcy. He said, we're going to move through this, and it's going to ultimately be a win. And I think that's not an unfair way to look at things. I mean, a lot of business people know that this is a very difficult process for the city, for its retirees, for its employees, for other stakeholders. They don't cheer it, but they do think, like a lot of business people, that's one of these, if they were making the decision, they would say, this is something that needs to happen. So let's get through it the best way we can and get to the other side. And I think Roger, like a lot of other business people, are cheered by the fact that there are efforts being made within the community to soften the blow for people like pensioners and to protect the DIA, although we didn't really talk about that. We talked more about the grand bargain in general.
Right.
But I think it's evocative of what I hear in the business community, which is nobody's cheering this, but they do think this is something that needs to happen and that the city and the business and the community are probably going to be better for it.
And as you point out in your column in the news today, when you kind of think of where Detroit was and really how far it has come, thinking of when the Super Bowl happened. Remember all the boarded up buildings that they had to paint with fake windows to make it look like there was life, and now those buildings are happening downtown.
Yeah, and he pointed that out to me. So, you know, in 2002 when Bill Ford Jr. called him and said, hey, we're going to get the Super Bowl here and I'd like you to spearhead the effort. He was like, oh boy, this is going to be a lot of work. But he did it, and now you get on the other side, and to your point, yeah, there are some buildings that were boarded up that are now active and things are happening. You know, the story of Detroit of its revival is a process. A lot of people are very impatient, and I would say even childish, are very skeptical of any moves forward and can always point to the negative things, but it's really a process. And I think when you go back to 2008, when we had three CEOs from the car companies and Ron Gettelfinger from the UAW in front of a congressional committee and getting lacerated by these people, that was a real low point. And then it got even lower when General Motors and Chrysler went into bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
But since that time, I think you've seen a lot of steady and positive progress by those companies. It hasn't been free and it hasn't been painless. There have been people that lost jobs and plants that were closed. But now we're on the other side of that, and these companies are a lot more profitable. They're a lot more lean. They're restructured. And the same thing's happening with the city. We don't really know if the city of Detroit, when it gets on the other side, is going to be as successful running their business, if you will, as General Motors and Chrysler and Ford seem to be. But I think we can pretty well guess that it's going to be in a better shape than it was before it went into bankruptcy.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
This is the future.
You built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
It's alive!
It's the sound of science!
General Motors installed the first robot at a plant 53 years ago in New Jersey. That robot could weld and move parts that weighed up to 500 pounds. Since that seminal moment in 1961, robots have become common in many workplaces, even as many human workers eye them with distrust. An Oxford University report published earlier this year predicted that robots could replace nearly half of the current U.S. workforce. Or could they? Can humans keep up or even keep ahead of the technology changing the workforce? These are especially important questions here in Michigan, with its historic ties to the auto industry, which makes up about 40% of the global supply of industrial robots. Stephen Spurr is chair of the Department of Economics and professor at Wayne State University. So good to have you with us on Stateside.
Oh, thank you, Cynthia.
Well, that Oxford University report that predicts that robots could replace nearly half of the current American workforce, do you agree with that report?
Well, not necessarily. I'm not sure exactly what they have in mind there, but I think what they're looking at is what we call the substitution effect of one factor of production for another. And that's the sort of thing that it's only half of the story. You also have to look at what we call the scale effect. And the way that works is, for example, in the case of robots, if you introduce a more productive kind of machine, what you're really doing is lowering the cost of capital.
Okay.
And in effect, so what that means is that whenever you lower the price of a factor like capital, then there's a tendency to substitute for labor. So you would be laying off workers who would be in effect replaced by the robots on the assembly line. However, you also have to think about the scale effect, and what the scale effect is all about is that if you reduce the cost of production, you are going to ultimately lower the cost of the product that you're selling, such as automobiles, and then people are going to buy more automobiles, and that means an expansion of output of the factory, which means they have to hire other factors of production to produce more. So they're going to hire more accountants, more lawyers, more computer programmers, more systems analysts, more bookkeepers, all kinds of other types of labor to, in effect, to add to their labor force. So that's something that has to be considered, too.
So it sounds like good news if you're an accountant, bad news if you were working on the line.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
And that's what we've seen playing out in Michigan. In fact, I love that term that I've seen you use in interviews, a hollowing out of jobs because of robots. Explain more what that means.
Well, what that means is that the sort of the middle of the road type jobs seem to be disappearing. There's some evidence that there's more demand for highly skilled workers and in some cases relatively low skilled workers, but not much for the sort of the middle of the road routine types of jobs.
And when these lower skilled or middle of the road routine jobs workers are replaced by technology, replaced by robots, where do they shift to? What kind of jobs do they shift to?
Well, they basically they have to. In the short run, they may shift to other types of jobs other than in the industries that they replace. But basically, there's a problem in that they have to the increase in jobs tends to be for the highly skilled and to some extent for the low skilled. So they have to scramble a little bit.
And this is certainly something we've seen happening, you know, especially in the last 7-8 years in Southeast Michigan, with such a heavy reliance on these lower skilled industrial jobs.
Right. Well, there's a lot of evidence that with the advances in technology, that the high skilled workers are sort of complementary with the machines and technology, and the middle to low skilled people are being substituted for. So that's probably the trend. Now, I should say also that, you know, the workforce is not a stagnant kind of entity. I mean, what we've seen actually is that there's more and more people are understanding this. And so we have more and more students who are coming out of high school and want to enter what we call the STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math. And I've recently seen quite a bit of evidence of this, which sort of surprised me because these fields have been less popular in the past. But people are basically understanding that this is the way the economy is going, and they're adapting to it.
I was intrigued by some interviews that I read with you strongly disagreeing with European economists who maintain that there is a finite number of jobs. Why do you think that's a misconception?
Well, it's a misconception, and actually it's a very widely held misconception. And the reason it's a misconception is that it is not true that there are a finite number of jobs, and so that, for example, if we want to provide job opportunities for young people, we have to make sure that we have the older people retire at a certain age. That's just not true. What makes people productive is their human capital. And so if they have the training and the human capital to do a job, they can do a job. Now, they may have to start a business, or they may be doing their job in different ways, but they have the potential to be productive. So it's just not true that there is, you know, X number of jobs, and so there's this increasing competition for this finite number. We always have expansions in different industries when there's a demand for it.
Steve, I'm interested in your thoughts. What jobs do you believe won't exist in 10 or 20 years?
Well, I guess just judging from what's gone on in the past, it's really hard to say. But I think I would go along with kind of the conventional wisdom on that, which is that the routine jobs that can be done by rote are going to be disappearing if they haven't already. So, for example, routine accounting work is being replaced by things like TurboTax. So many of the assembly line jobs have almost disappeared and will continue to disappear. For example, my son works in New Jersey, and when he shops for groceries, he doesn't go to the grocery and walk around the aisles and put things into a shopping cart. What he does is he goes to a website, and they have a record of what he's ordered in the past, and so he can either order the same bundle of groceries, or he can tweak it and add other groceries. And then he submits that, you know, that's a click of the mouse. And then he also indicates the time that he wants to pick up the groceries. So then he goes there, and somebody brings the groceries out to his car. So what that does is eliminates the need for somebody to answer the phone and take his order. So those types of very routine, not very, you know, those kinds of jobs are going to be replaced. We can pretty well count on that.
But do you envision a scenario where we would have close to a zero labor economy? Would we move away from having human workers for the most part?
Well, no, I don't think so. But I would say this, that there's a tendency, there's a historical tendency, I mean, very clear, that when the real wage increases over historical time, the hours of work declines. So, for example, in 1890, the normal work week in the U.S. was 60 hours. And by 1914, it was less than 56, and now it's down to 40 or less in the U.S. We also know that if you compare the U.S. with other countries in the world, the countries where the real wage is lower, people have a longer work week. I mean, people work a lot more hours in Bangladesh, people who are working full-time, than full-time workers in the U.S. So I think, yes, we will work less hours, fewer hours, but I don't think we're going to be released from doing any work, at least not in the foreseeable future.
Stephen Spur is the chair of the Wayne State University Department of Economics. It's been very interesting talking robots with you, Steve. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks.
That is some great banjo, isn't it? We want to invite you to check in. Let us know what issues and stories you're following or interesting people in Michigan that we should know about and share their story with everyone else. It's easy to reach us. We're on Facebook, Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter, at Stateside Radio. And as always, you can go to michiganradio.org and just click on the link that says Stateside. Next time on Stateside, can the city of Flint afford further cuts in police and fire services?
In this situation, almost 3 years under state receivership, there is absolutely a state role in the solution.
A conversation with Flint's Mayor Dane Walling. That's next time on Stateside. Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Omar Sadeh, Katie Suha, and Jeff Morniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.